It's Thursday, September 12th. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Major U.S. cities might feel more crowded than ever, but some of the biggest are actually seeing populations decline.
For the first time in many, many decades, the New York City metro area, the Los Angeles metro area, and the Chicago metro area, all three are at the same time losing population.
Migration away from major metro areas could have political implications for the future of the country. Also on the show, a real-life Russian spy story that feels much stranger than fiction.
Sometimes people who come here do not want to, in fact, take on a new identity. They want to live in the open. They want to be proud of what they did. And they don't believe that Putin would go after them on American soil.
Plus, the new movie Hustlers is gaining attention for actually empowering strippers and sex workers on screen. We'll hear from the on-set consultant who helped the filmmakers get it right. First up, Americans on the move. For the first time in decades, the populations of the biggest metro areas in the United States are going down. That's according to a Bloomberg News analysis of new census data. In 2018, New York alone lost 100,000 people. Chicago and Los Angeles also saw big declines. Meanwhile, smaller cities in the West and the South are growing. For some people, leaving major metro areas is about basic quality of life, but for many, it's also about job opportunities or more affordable housing. And we asked you what drove you to make the big move in the last few years.
Hi, this is Alexa. I relocated up to Beacon from New York City. Cheaper than the city in terms of rent and utilities, plus they don't require vast amounts of wealth.
Hi, this is John from Buffalo, and I moved to Buffalo in 2010 after being wiped out by the Great Recession. I moved to Buffalo from Chicago because the cost of living was much cheaper here, especially for housing.
Hi, this is Sarah Odlin from Taylor's Falls, Minnesota. A few years ago, our family moved from our first-ring suburb into this rural exurb area. My husband and I both grew up on farms, and we really wanted to give our kids the space to spend more time in nature the way we did.
Thanks for sharing. As for me, I'm a native of New York City, but it's definitely expensive and very, very crowded. And while I think I'm going to stick around New York for a while, it's hard to ignore what seems like a trend. Joining me now is Jana Johnson, an economist, demographer, and assistant professor at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. Jana, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, Tanzina. Great to be here.
And Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So, Jana, I want to start with you. Broadly speaking, how common is it today for people to make big moves in the United States?
So we've been able to measure migration within the United States, internal migration, as scholars like myself refer to it. And we've been able to measure it since the 60s or so with national surveys, et cetera. So the way that we measure this is on an annual basis, usually. We ask people, did you move in the last year? If so, from where? The way that we measure long-distance migration is the interstate migration rate. But interestingly, over the last 30 years, we've actually seen a pretty big decline in the interstate migration rate. Back in the 1980s, it was over 3% of the population moved between states in a given year. Now it's down to 1.5%, so it's really halved since the 1980s. We know that older people tend to move less than younger people, and we know the U.S. population is getting older, so maybe it's that. Maybe jobs are becoming more similar across places, so people don't have to move as much to get their ideal job. And actually, none of these explanations that people have looked at have seemed to explain much of this decline. So it still remains a pretty big mystery in terms of why people are moving less within the U.S.
Derek, you've written about population decline in big cities like New York, Chicago, Los Angeles. Where are people going?
It's absolutely true that people are moving less. That is clearly a modern phenomenon, that you have less interstate mobility. At the same time, another modern phenomenon that's important is that those who are moving tend to be moving to the south and to the west, to the suburbs of large metros like Phoenix and Las Vegas and Dallas and Houston. And what I explored in my piece in The Atlantic is the fact that for the first time in many, many decades, all three of the top major metros in the United States, New York City, the New York City metro area, the Los Angeles metro area, and the Chicago metro area, all three are at the same time losing population. And where are they losing population to? Well, people are moving from these mostly expensive, mostly dense places to the South and to the West. In Los Angeles's case, because it is in the South and the West, the people who are moving from Los Angeles seem to be moving to Phoenix, to Las Vegas, to Dallas, and then to the Inland Empire, to places that are a little bit east within California.
Why are people moving? I mean, what's attracting them to cities in the South and in the West? I mean, I live in New York, born and raised here, and I'm going to gather that cost is one reason.
I think a huge bit of this is cost, especially for New York City and Los Angeles. In New York, obviously, you don't get a lot of real estate for your money. It's a wonderful city for restaurants and culture. It's not a great city for making your money go a long way toward buying real estate or renting apartments. So I think a lot of people are moving from New York in their late 20s, early 30s, because they want to start a family and they want more space for their family. Maybe they even want a lawn, and you're much more likely to find that in a place like Texas than you are on the Upper East Side. In Los Angeles, I think it's a slightly different story. What's happening, I think, is that the demand to live in Los Angeles is outstripping the housing supply. So as a result, you see that housing prices are absolutely or have absolutely skyrocketed in Los Angeles County. And as a result, a lot of middle-class families are saying, look, I'd much rather live in a place that has Los Angeles weather without Los Angeles prices. And so where are they moving? Well, they're moving essentially to Las Vegas and Phoenix. So some of them are moving, you know, to the Inland Empire, but some of them are essentially saying, I can essentially use Las Vegas or Phoenix to be essentially my southwestern suburb.
Jana, if, as you said, people are moving, interstate mobility is less than we've seen since the 80s, is there an economic implication that we can take away from that?
The interesting thing about this big decline is that, so some of my colleagues' work has looked at this, so this overall rate of people moving within the U.S. has fallen, but interestingly, the rate at which population reallocates themselves within the United States, you know, from one place to another, that hasn't really changed so much. And so it's unlikely that what's going on is that some places are becoming more attractive economically than others, because if that was what was going on, we'd see this change in net migration, this change in the shifting of population around the U.S. And that really doesn't seem to have changed since the 1980s. And as Derek was referring to, one of the main reasons that people always cite for why they moved are job-related reasons. But since 2000 or so, the number of people who cite that as a top reason for why they moved in terms of getting a better job, that has actually declined. So indicating that other sorts of reasons, whether they're family-related or what we economists like to call amenity-related in terms of, you know, liking Los Angeles weather better than that, say, in Minneapolis, those things may be becoming more important in driving people's decisions whether to move or not and where to go.
Derek, you have also written about the some pretty major population shifts that we've seen in this country in the 20th century. Let's talk a little bit about those. I mean, I think the first one that comes to mind is the Great Migration of African Americans in the mid-20th century. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Great Migration in the 20th century of Black Americans from the South to northern metros was an unbelievably important force, not only for demography, but also for politics. You had the Black population of cities like Baltimore and Cleveland and Chicago go from 2% Black in 1900 to close to 30 or 40% Black in 1950, 1960. And what effect did this have? Well, as Blacks were moving into northern cities, they forged an alliance with urban liberals, and they pushed the Democratic Party to prioritize civil rights in the middle of the 20th century. So that when Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act in 1964, Kennedy had been elected by a large share of Southern rural whites, but only one Southern senator from Texas voted for the Civil Rights Act. So not only did the Great Migration push the Democratic Party to prioritize civil rights, it also encouraged the Democratic Party to cut ties with its Southern white flank. As a result, entirely changing the face of modern politics as we know it. Now, I think we could see a really similar thing happen in the next 20 years or so, that if the political implications of the Great Migration were to change the face of American politics, what you're now seeing is a kind of reverse Great Migration. A lot of millennial Black families and Hispanic families within the diverse millennial generation are moving to the suburbs of the South and West. They're moving into metros like Atlanta, Dallas, Phoenix. Now, what do all those metros have in common? A, they all tend to vote blue. B, they're all in states that currently vote red. So if you have a lot of liberal millennials moving into southern metros, you could see Georgia, Texas, and Arizona shift from deep red territory in elections to purplish or even light blue territory, once again potentially changing the American electoral map.
Jenna, I'm wondering, what do we know about those who do migrate? I mean, I think there's, as Derek and I were just pointing out, there's the cost of a city, right? New York is too expensive, so we'll move to somewhere that's less expensive for what some people say quality of life. But are there other factors that weigh when someone is thinking of moving out of state, particularly from a bigger city? Are there older folks who are weighing, say, the cost of retirement? Are there people who, you know, have to move because they're being pushed out because of rising rents? And not so much as a choice, but more as a forced option.
I think that both of those mechanisms could definitely be at play here in terms of driving people's decisions to move or not and where to go. But the hard thing to really know based on the data that we have available to us is what's really going on. Because one of the great things that we would really like to know is not only did you move in the last year and where did you move from, but what happened 5 years ago, 10 years ago, earlier on in your life. Migration is a really big decision, and it's a decision that we don't do it that often in our lives. And just knowing what you did in the past year, that's really not as informative as knowing what your entire location or migration history from, say, your early teens up through adulthood. That sort of data is really not very available in publicly available data in the U.S.
Derek, how do you mentioned politically how this could play out, but are you also in your reporting, have you found that maybe millennials or younger generations are more interested perhaps in moving than older generations were?
Here's how to answer that question. If you look at a graph of likelihood to move based on age, what you tend to see is a really big hump between the early 20s and the late 30s. So from the years after you graduate from college to the years when you're starting a family. That tells me that the group of Americans that are moving right now are smack dab in the middle of the millennial generation. And what's important to note about that for political purposes is that the millennial generation we have seen is really liberal. It's not just more liberal than the rest of the country today. It's also more liberal than previous generations of young Americans. They have voted for the Democratic presidential candidate at record high margins. And that just leads me to think that if the prime age to move interstate now, if that window is now entirely opening onto the millennial generation, what you're seeing happen now and within the next, say, 10, 15 years is a move of liberals, many of them from dense northeastern metros toward less dense south and western suburbs. And a lot of those south and western suburbs are in red states.
Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and Jenna Johnson is an economist and demographer and assistant professor at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tanzina.
This week, we got a small window into the world of U.S. intelligence operations overseas, with news that the CIA pulled one of its most valuable spies out of Russia in 2017 over concerns about his safety. The spy reportedly worked close to President Vladimir Putin and had provided the U.S. government with information on Russian interference efforts for the 2016 election. The extraction reportedly left the United States with little insight into what happens at some of the highest levels of the Russian government at a critical moment. David Sanger is a senior writer and national security correspondent for The New York Times. David, thanks for coming back on The Takeaway.
Great to be with you, Tanzina.
So what do we know about the person and the information that they were providing to the U.S. government? Because it seems like if we're talking about Russian interference in the 2016 election, that's something we need to know.
Well, in fact, as you know, we've known a fair bit about the information and the existence of this person since 2016, since the elections. And in The Perfect Weapon, a book I wrote about cybersecurity issues, I wrote that the CIA director under President Obama, John Brennan, was in the summer of 2016 bringing reports to the White House in a separate envelope. He wouldn't put it in the presidential daily brief because they came from very high-level assets that they had in and around Putin's orbit, and that one in particular had been particularly productive. And that this was, in the end, how they established that Putin himself had ordered the hack on the DNC, had ordered many of the other interference activities that we later came to know about. And at the end of 2016, the Obama administration, just before leaving office, made an effort to exfiltrate him, bring him to the United States. And he resisted, we understood at that time, said that it was for family reasons. I mean, who knows? But that happens at times. What we've learned in recent days is that they succeeded in 2017, shortly after President Trump took over. He did come to the United States. And then, of course, the Russians leaked out his name once the stories began appearing. And then once the name leaked out, of course, the oddity is we began to find references to it on the internet in land transactions from apparently when he purchased a house.
Why would the Russian media publish his name?
Because they wanted to establish that he really wasn't terribly important. When you read the Russian accounts from him, they say that he was had a drinking problem. They say that he was low level, that he was never near Putin, and so forth and so on. I can't speak to the drinking issues, but we certainly can speak to the question of the quality of the information we got. And based on our sources, it was quite good. We believe, in fact, that he was an aide to a very senior Russian diplomat who's assigned to the Kremlin. So while he wasn't based in the Kremlin himself, he was likely in and out and certainly had access through one of Putin's top aides to what was going on.
Has there been any official response from the Russian government and or the U.S. government so far?
The U.S. government has said nothing, as you would expect, about an agent that they repatriated. And I can understand why you want to protect the name and the whereabouts of this kind of person. They're rightly concerned about his safety. From the Russian government, we have not heard anything that would suggest official acknowledgement. But then they had many of their semi-official news organizations, including Kommersant, publish these sort of disinformation stories to denigrate him.
David, you almost think that it's almost impossible for spies to be found out. I mean, this is part of why they're spies, right? When they are extracted to the U.S. or to other countries, what are some of the risks that they face?
Well, the greatest example, of course, is the Skripal case, which was a case of a spy for the British who had been caught in Moscow, imprisoned, and returned to Britain in a spy swap. And they thought at that point, you know, people would sort of leave him alone. Well, it turned out that because he had been rather active and going off and talking about Russia and its intelligence networks to other countries and so forth, that he was the subject, of course, of that terrible nerve agent attack a year and a half ago. So there is considerable risk, particularly these days. The Russians have not attempted something like that nerve agent attack in the United States, and there are reasons to doubt that they would. But you never know, and I think that's part of the concern here.
David, the Washington Post said that they were able to find the home of the man the Russian media is naming as the CIA source right outside of D.C. Now, if this is actually the home of this alleged spy, doesn't it put him at risk and his family at risk to report all of this information out to the public?
It certainly does, and we found the home as well. And one of our reporters, Julian Barnes, went out there as well. But what we don't know is whether the name that the Russians are putting out is in fact the spy in question. I mean, we can't 100% verify that. all of the circumstantial evidence seems to suggest it was. And it does raise a really interesting question that since the CIA has this fairly detailed and super secret relocation program where they take people and they give them new identities and so forth, why would this person have bought a house in the Washington suburbs under his own name? And the answer to that, I'm told by some intelligence officials, is that sometimes people who come here do not want to, in fact, take on a new identity. They want to live in the open. They want to be proud of what they did. And they don't believe that Putin would go after them on American soil.
And of course, bringing it back to the election here in 2020, what does this story tell us, if anything, about how we think about the U.S. intelligence community and Russian interference in our elections more broadly, but also the concern about that as we head into this 2020 presidential election?
Well, the concern is deep and wide in the U.S. government, with one exception, which is the president, with whom they can't discuss the topic. As Kirstjen Nielsen noted shortly before and after she was relieved as the Secretary of Homeland Security, the president views any discussion of this issue as an attack on the legitimacy of his own election. But certainly you're seeing the Department of Homeland Security, the National Security Agency, the FBI, other units of the U.S. government trying to think ahead to 2020. And there's one thing we know, which is that whatever the Russians do, they're not going to replay the same playbook that they used in 2016, because Facebook would be waiting for them, Twitter would be waiting for them. There are some things we are deeply worried about, and one of them I've written about in recent times in The Times, that if you've seen this wave of ransomware attacks that have hit the states over the summer, it's an interesting question. What would happen if there was a ransomware attack that hit the voter registration systems, and when you went to the polling places, they were frozen up and they couldn't establish that you were who you said you were, or that you hadn't moved to Arizona last week, or something like that?
David Sanger, senior writer and national security correspondent for the New York Times. David, we appreciate you joining us today.
Always great to be with you.
At first glance, the film Hustlers might seem to follow a similar formula to other splashy con artist films. An all-star ensemble cast, a flashy setting, and unsuspecting marks. But this one is a little different. Featuring Jennifer Lopez, Constance Wu, Cardi B, and Lizzo, it's about a group of strippers who, for once, aren't the characters being taken advantage of. In a film and TV landscape where there have been so many negative portrayals of women who work in this industry, Hustlers is receiving critical praise for painting an honest and nuanced portrait of strippers today. Here's a clip of Jennifer Lopez's character Ramona teaching Destiny, played by Constance Wu, different movements on the pole.
Front hook.
Ankle hook.
Yep.
Knee hook.
Hold on with that knee.
Okay.
From here, you can do the carousel.
Put your head back.
One reason this movie might feel different from others that depict the world of strippers is that the film's writer and director, Laureen Scafaria, hired Jacqueline Francis, who goes by Jack the Stripper, as a consultant on the film. And she joins me now in studio. Welcome to The Takeaway, Jack.
Thanks for having me.
So excited for you to be here. So when you look at films and shows that portray the world of strippers and sex workers, what are some of the biggest problems you see?
There is so much violence against sex workers in movies, and it's treated with humor, and it's not funny because it's a very real problem. And it's also heavily pathologized. Everyone's like, what made you do this? Why are you here? As if anybody should have to explain why they have to survive under capitalism.
There's that, right? I mean, like, and when Hustlers, when they started working on the film, what was it about the story that made you want to work on the film?
Well, I read the article on The Cut in 2015, and I was stripping in New York in 2015, and I was very envious of these women. I was like, oh, I wish I did that. So I read the story, and then when I heard it was getting developed, I was nervous, you know, because it talks about a very specific incident that strippers, you know, are committing a crime, and that's something that we have to talk about. But when I read the script, Laureen just put so much humor and compassion into it, and that's what I'm here for.
So you ended up working on the set.
Yes.
What were some of the things in the film that you had to make sure these actresses, you know, a lot of them who are now household names, had to get right about the world of stripping and the work that they probably hadn't done before?
Yeah, so I helped with a lot of movement. Like, a lot of times when people dance like a pole dancer, you're thinking, like, jazz hands. And I'm like, absolutely, let's not do jazz hands. With your hands, touch your body. But I think what was more important for my involvement in the film was just sort of helping the actors understand the backstory of why we work this way, what the logic is behind it. Like, they're running a business. And the movie is a lot about how these women are running a business. So I was just sort of filling in on why the industry is the way it is. For example, in this one scene when there's a boundary negotiation with Constance in one of the clients, he's asking her to do something that she doesn't want to do. And I gave a note to Lorraine saying he would be begging more, because people forget, people don't understand how much men beg for what they want in strip clubs. And so she took the note, and it was so much more accurate for me. It was like, the beggingness of the character really came through. And I don't know, I've never seen that in a movie before, but that's much more true to what my experience is like in VIP rooms in New York.
And do you think a lot of it had to do with the fact that there was a woman behind the camera? You were on set. These were women. You know, Cardi B has worked in this industry before. Like, do you think that helped to flesh out a little bit more of the realism and the comfort level that the actors felt?
Yeah, I mean, this movie is about the female gaze, and that's awesome. This movie is totally women admiring and appreciating other women and working together to achieve goals, however amoral and complicated they may be.
Now, you also worked as a care consultant on set. What was that? What do you do?
So a comfort consultant, that's like a new job that's coming up. But intimacy coordinator is something that is starting to happen in films that portray sexual contact. So we weren't like simulating sex on set, but I was there to be like, are you comfortable with this move? Are you comfortable doing this? If you're not, let's try something else. Like, it's not about doing exactly what you think you're supposed to do as a stripper. It's about doing an expression of what feels right to you, what feels natural to you. So we're working with Constance and Jennifer to be like, well, how would you want to move? If there's a move that you don't enjoy, don't do it. The last thing that we want anyone to feel is uncomfortable. So we just made sure everyone was feeling comfortable doing what they were doing. If they weren't, we could change it. It was flexible.
I like that you say that this is about the female gaze, because I think a lot of the interpretation of what happens in strip clubs, at least in the media, is often that men are in charge.
Well, men run the places, and it's not ideal, but women are the ones who keep the money coming in. So we need to remember that and appreciate that and show some respect to strippers.
When you talk to other strippers that you know, how do they feel about this film coming out? Are they going, oh, God, here we go again? Or do they feel like this might be an opportunity to get it right?
I think there's a lot of anxiety because of how negatively sex workers are portrayed in mainstream media. There's a lot of stress. Like, what is this going to be like? Is this going to be bad for business, good for business? Is this going to help take away the stigma? Is it going to help break it down? Or is it going to make it worse? And I really hope that they enjoy it. This is a movie that is supposed to be entertaining for strippers to celebrate how hard they work. And I hope that that comes across.
The hard work, because again, I think it's something that, like you said, it's either pathologized or it's seen as, well, I can just go to work and this is so easy, and it's not easy.
Well, I mean, go and do it if you think it's so easy, guys.
I wouldn't even, I don't even know what would happen. I would definitely fall off the stage, off the pole, off all the things. Now, you know, turning to a little bit more of a serious tone here, I mean, we hear a lot about violence against sex workers in this country who are doing work that's considered criminal. But we hear less so about stripping. And I wonder if strippers are facing similar kind of stigma and also violence in the work that they do, because it's a vulnerable position to be in, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think in my experience as a stripper, I've been doing it for almost 10 years. The violence that I wouldn't say experience violence at work. I feel generally quite safe in clubs. But the way that I'm treated when I step outside of the club, when people find out what about what I do, is where I feel most disrespected. And that is challenging. And like, this movie is about in 2008 when the stock market crashed and everyone had to get creative with how they make money, right? The same thing happened in 2018, 10 years later, different. It wasn't a stock market crash. They passed this bill, FOSTA-SESTA, that made sex work so much more dangerous for everybody trying to do it. Like, they took down Backpage. So now sex workers are trying to be extremely resourceful and creative with, like, how they're going to hustle to make ends meet. And that's important that we have to talk about that, because sex workers are facing increased violence since this bill passed, even though the intention was to, like, save sex workers. It, let me be clear, did not. So it's all about being resourceful and trying to figure out. We need to talk about this. Like, we need to decriminalize sex work, because if you believe in a woman's right to choose to do what she wants with her body, that includes doing what she wants with how she makes a living with it.
Are you seeing yourself and maybe other sex workers getting more involved in the politics?
Sex workers have been so involved politically for a very long time. I will say they are finally getting the recognition they deserve as advocates, as activists, as organizers. They work so hard, and they've always worked hard, but mainstream media is finally paying attention.
What about legislators? I mean, are they going to start paying attention? You mentioned FOSTA SESTA. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if maybe at more of a local level, we've got a little less than a minute left, but do you think that will start to change?
Let's hope so. Let's hope so. Let's listen to sex workers. You know, let's listen to the people who are affected by this. Let's not try to control what people do with their bodies. Let's just listen and have compassion for how people are trying to make it in this world. And let's let their stories lead with how we do legislation.
I've been speaking with Jacqueline Francis, who goes by Jack the Stripper, a stripper and consultant on the set of Hustlers. Thanks so much for joining us, Jack.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's our show for today. If you don't already, make sure to follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway. And you can find me at Tanzina Vega. And of course, we're on Facebook and Instagram as well. Our team includes producers Alexandra Boti, Ethan Oberman, Polly Irungu, Jose Olivares, Jivika Varma, Rob Gunther, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, and Andres O'Hara. Our engineers are Debbie Daughtry, Vince Fairchild, and Jake Howitt. David Gable is our administrative assistant, and Lita Hallowell is our intern. Deidre Depke is our executive producer. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you'll join me again next time. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.